Okay, bear with me, because I think maybe as a way to cope, I don't know, but this week I totally binge-watched season 8 of The Walking Dead. So, a couple of things. One, I don't really like the blood, guts, and gore. That's not why I watch it, so don't judge me. Two, I watch it on fast forward. I'm not even kidding. I watch it on single fast forward with the subtitles on so that you can get all of the action but without having to wait through everything else, because I'm as annoyed by the gratuitous gore as I am by the gratuitous suspense. You know, just you're always waiting for something to happen. So I didn't spend as long watching it as you're thinking I did. But still, I watched it. Because I love a good story, and especially if it asks spiritual or existential questions, and especially if it asks me to examine myself. Because, and hang with me here, there are a lot of similarities between The Walking Dead and the Hebrew Bible. Like, the whole first couple of seasons of The Walking Dead are all about what does it mean to be human? And how can we tell what humanity is, right? That's a lot like Genesis 1 and 2. And then it moves on to ask the question of what is evil? And how do we deal with evil? So you can see it's basically the same story of the people of God. But then it moves on, and season 8 was all about what makes something just. How do you know the difference between justice and mercy? And how do you ever settle the us versus them question? I could go on with more similarities, but basically the setting these questions in the hypothetical of the zombie apocalypse strips away all of the other barriers that keep us from seeing the real moral and ethical questions and allows us to have a new perspective on our actual values. And we're at the same point in the story of the Hebrew Bible today, in the narrative of the ancient Israelites. Once you've broken free from evil, what does justice look like? When we left off last week, you may remember, Moses had an encounter at this same place that the story takes place today, on Mount Sinai, sometimes called Mount Horeb. God spoke to Moses through the burning bush on this sacred ground. And God tells Moses, "I have heard the cries of my people in Egypt, and I am sending you to go and set them free from slavery." So Moses goes. And when he gets to Egypt, there is this struggle with Pharaoh. Moses says, "Let my people go." And Pharaoh says, "No." And God, through Moses, sends plague after plague, gnats and frogs and hail and boils and darkness. And the epic struggle to gain freedom from their enslavement. And with the final plague being widespread death that affects every Egyptian family and household. It feels like this freedom at any cost, with increasing stakes, until finally the Pharaoh just says, "Just go." So the Israelites, having escaped the wave of death by using a secret code, the blood of a lamb over their doorways, so that the wave of death passes over their homes, so that only the Egyptians feel this particular final blow, the Israelites then sneak out under cover of darkness, and they must leave so quickly that they don't have time to add leaven to their bread and wait for it to rise. I imagine it happened exactly like the children's sermon. Lots of throwing things into bowls, a little bit of chaos, and then finally just herding cats out the door on the way to another place. So they make their getaway. And the meal that results from that quick escape after death has passed over them becomes the Passover meal that the people celebrate each year after that, all the way until the time of Jesus, And it's at that Passover meal, so many years later, that Jesus and his friends are celebrating, that that meal becomes his Last Supper, the model for our communion feast. But we're getting to that. So Moses leads the people out on a midnight escape, but Pharaoh changes his mind. In the midst of his own grief, he gathers all of the Egyptian army, and their horses and chariots come charging after Moses and the Israelites, and they catch up to them at the Red Sea. And the Israelites are caught with the sea before them and the army behind them, and they can't go around it. They can't go under it. So Moses raises his staff, and the waters part, and the Israelites are able to go through the Red Sea on dry ground and make it to safety. Which, of course, isn't the end of the story. As any of us know who've been through any sort of trauma, hopefully none of us have experienced exactly what the Israelites are experiencing, but make the connection to your own life. Is it coming out of addiction or a toxic relationship, abuse, or deep grief or loss? The initial escape, as it were, is never the end of the story. There's a whole wilderness to walk through on our way to finding a new normal. And the Israelites must go through that too. And they're not in the wilderness long before they run out of unleavened bread. And they're hungry. So God gives them a new kind of food. Manna, a mysterious bread-like substance that miraculously appears in the morning. But then they're thirsting, and God gives them water straight from a rock. And Moses brings this bedraggled, hungry, thirsty, post-traumatic crew. He drags them all the way to the last place that he had an encounter with the divine, back to where the rescue plan was hatched. He drags them to Mount Sinai, where he saw the burning bush. And after that whole ordeal, they all need an experience of God. They're looking at having to rebuild a society. And none of them, except for Moses, have ever lived in anything except for slavery. So they're looking for the next set of instructions. And here they get, for the first time, not a covenant. God is not just a covenant. God has already made covenants with them. God made covenants with Noah and Abraham and Sarah. But this time, they need more than a promise. They have been treated as subhuman for so long. They need to know how to live as people. They need to know what justice looks like. See, it's a lot like The Walking Dead, I told you. Rolf Jacobson, in his commentary on this passage, said that if you've ever been delivered from any sort of bondage, then the Ten Commandments look like freedom. They look like a gift. But if you've never experienced that kind of bondage, then they may look like they're restricting your freedom. I can't relate exactly to how the people are feeling at this part of the story, but I have experienced trauma and grief, and this reminds me of what I've done when I'm trying to find a new normal. I set up rituals. I make new intentional habits so that I can focus on doing just the next right thing. I simplify. I take advice. And so they go to God and they ask for how shall we live? Because we need rituals in the time of trauma and transition. It's why we have memorial services, for instance. Because returning to the familiarity of a ritual shapes us and holds us together. And we should also keep in mind the timing of when these stories were written down. These stories were all penned after the exile. In the midst of unutterable loss, in the midst of destruction, havoc, violence, betrayal, hypocrisy, and death surrounding the community. So I think, what stories would I tell my children in that same kind of setting? I would tell them stories that tell them the God who made you loves you, that you are seen and you are special. Stories like this, where God tells a terrified people, "You will be my treasured people, a priestly kingdom," and gives them a set of principles by which to gauge right and wrong. When it's read, though, out of context, if we just take those Ten Commandments but leave the surrounding story behind, when that same narrative is read to and through the people with power who haven't experienced trauma, it becomes entitlement and exceptionalism. It becomes an impossible code. You can take the same narrative, and when you're marginalized, it makes God's love more expansive. It makes it, yes, even you. But you tell the same story to and as the people who are on top, who hold the power, and it makes God's love exclusionary and narrow. It's as though these commandments were written from the underground, a place that at times can be hard for us to access if we hold a lot of privilege ourselves. Often these laws can seem stifling, but when we see real injustice, we can see how a firm grasp on what justice is can be a gift. Having a whole community concur about how we will treat one another is a gift when you see it not happening. And setting this law within a narrative is significant. Bruce Birch, in his book, Let Justice Roll Down, says that it shows Israel's belief that the authority of its foundational laws are connected with God's liberating action, which brought them out of Egypt. The law does not stand in independence from the story. It is woven into the narrative throughout, here at the Ten Commandments and later on, whenever they'll get the longer law code. Terence Fretheim points out that this integration of law and narrative is unique in the ancient Near East. One of the most distinctive characteristics of the law found in the Hebrew Bible is that it is enclosed in narrative. And this integration keeps the divine action and the human response closely related to each other. In the Hebrew Bible, law parallels liturgy, like rituals, song, dance, in being embedded in the narrative. As such, law is understood as another way that the people respond to what God has done on their behalf. And law is more clearly seen as a gift of God's graciousness when you tie it to this story. It's just a part of the larger story of God's goodness and mercy. In order to see God's graciousness to us, then, we need to see how this speaks to our narrative. And we need justice right now just as much as the people did back then. We are living in what Walter Brueggemann would call a deeply distorted society. In his sermon, Called Against the Distortion, he says, "Too bad the Ten Commandments have been cheapened and moralized to become a vehicle for cultural wars, because the commandments are not simple little moral rules. They are, rather, God's abiding markers against all distortions of life that are sure to occur when the holy reality of God is displaced from the center of our existence. The summons of Sinai is that the people called by God are to live faithful lives as an alternative to the distortions that they have just witnessed. They're supposed to live lives that are different from the empire that they've just gained freedom from." Brueggemann goes on to say, "I believe that now the church must think afresh what such a faithful life would look like. Because it is now God's call to the church to live according to God's purposes in the midst of a deeply distorted society." So what is this narrative calling us to today? What is our response in the midst of the injustice of our story? The Apostle Paul helps us out a little here in chapter 13 of the letter to the Romans when he reinterprets this ancient story in the light of the injustice that he is seeing in his time and his place. He says, "Let no debt remain outstanding except the continuing debt to love one another. For whoever loves others has fulfilled the law. The commandments, you shall not commit adultery, you shall not murder, you shall not steal, you shall not covet, and whatever other commandment there may be, are summed up in this one command. Love your neighbor as yourself. Love does no harm to a neighbor. Therefore, love is the fulfillment of the law." We are to love. Jesus, before Paul, shows us how to live in a deeply distorted society when he shows his love by laying down his life. The night that he knows he'll be betrayed, that he's going to experience that deep injustice, he shares a meal with his friends. A meal that recalls the ancient story of the people's escape from freedom, escape from slavery into freedom. A meal that is a gift integrated into the narrative, a sign of grace. The Israelites back then, Jesus, Paul, and us, we all know what it means to live in societies with deep injustice. We know what it means to feel powerless and helpless in the face of what we're trying to discern between what is right and what is wrong. We yearn for justice in the same way that the people in our ancient stories did, because it is so deeply evident that the world is hungry for righteousness. Today is World Communion Sunday, and today we celebrate this part of the story. What the people before us did in the face of evil. We celebrate this together with others around the world using the same symbols, coming back to the rituals that shape us, using bread and juice. This is our response to the action in the world, be it just or be it unjust. Our response is that we will be united in defiance and in hope. We will remember our ancient stories. We will cling to what is good. We will experience this feast as people who are hungry, in solidarity with all those around our world who still hunger and thirst for righteousness. May it be so. In the name of God, the Creator, Christ, and Holy Spirit. Amen.